for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Egypt's president blames violent protests on infiltrators inside the opposition. The U.S. engages Russia in a bid for a political solution to Syria's civil war. And details are emerging regarding the deadly factory fire in Bangladesh. Joining me for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast TV, and Matt Fry of the UK's Channel 4 News. I invite you to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Nadia, what's happening in Egypt?
Well, yesterday, President Morsi gave that anticipated speech, and it didn't seem to calm down anyone. We have seen massive demonstration as we speak now in front of Ittihadiyya Palace, where the president resides, and also in Tahrir Square. We have a committee called the Salvation Committee, which is basically the opposition parties, notably by Musa, Baradai, Sabhin, Hamdin Sabhin as well, all together refusing the dialogue that the President Morsi has offered. So the situation looks like going towards a dead end. The demonstration are demanding that the president should step down even. It just reminds us of the demonstrations we have seen during Mubarak time.
James.
You know, what worries me about this is that up until now, Morsi has displayed a pretty deft touch. And what we've seen here is he's definitely overstepped the boundaries, and he doesn't seem to be able to come back in any way that saves face. So he's digging in his heels. I mean, basically, this draft constitution that he's forcing a referendum on the middle of the month, 15th of December, is rejected by all the secularists, all the liberalists, all the people who basically started the revolution, and he's forcing it anyway. And he's basically, this constitution gives the military even more autonomy than they had under Mubarak, so he has the military on his side, but he doesn't have the people on his side, and that sounds a whole lot like Mubarak. So it's a very dicey situation right now.
It's interesting. Mohamed Al-Baradei, Nobel laureate, of course, former chief weapons inspector who was involved in the whole Iraq business, always warned that in the hot lava of Egypt's post-revolutionary transition, it would be a big mistake to have a president first and then deal with the constitution, then basically reinvent Egyptian society. And that's precisely what's happened. So what you have is that the process of drawing up a new constitution, of finding a level playing field for all the institutions in society, has been poisoned by power politics. And then you get to the character of Morsi himself, who, although, as James said, had displayed a very deft touch, and ironically had displayed that deftest of touches just a few days before he decided to issue his emergency decree, when he did all the right things over Gaza, comes from a fairly secretive political background, the Muslim Brotherhood, living in the shadows, living basically outside the mainstream, now finds himself running Egypt, but doesn't behave like the president of all Egyptians. He behaves like the president of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Who are the infiltrators he's talking about, Nadia?
Well, he sounds like the previous regime. Whenever you have a massive revolt against you and against your policies, you always blame the outsiders, these guys who belong to Western governments or conspiracy against the president. And he sounded in the beginning when people, he was saying basically, and the Muslim Brotherhood, to the degree that people around him, his own advisors, Diane, were resigning in protest. And they were saying, it's only a few people, don't worry about them, they will disappear. And now people are having tents set up in Tahrir Square saying, we're not going to accept this. We have to change that. This decree that you give yourself all this power, he's saying yesterday in his speech that, okay, once we have the referendum, I will resort back to where we were. But the problem is this referendum is illegal because he needs the judiciary, and the judiciary already protested against him. So whatever he's doing, he's really doomed.
Well, the real problem, I think, is also a lack of trust, born out of a toxic environment that had been created by decades of Mubarak rule. So he doesn't trust the judiciary. And he's right to not trust them completely, because after all, they dissolved the democratically elected assembly that was supposed to begin with the drafting of a constitution earlier this year. He doesn't trust the military, but he fears them, which is why he allowed in his new draft constitution or in his decree to have a military officer as the defense minister. So no civilian oversight of the army. That would be a disaster given Egypt's background. And, which I think is really telling, in a process of drafting a new constitution up for vote that should have lasted a month, this guy, basically, or 3 months, he crammed it through in one day.
One night.
Absolutely. So is he becoming an Islamist dictator?
You know, it's a very good question. We're going to find out pretty quick. If he digs his heels in, decides he has the military on his side and can force this this constitution down the throats of the Egyptians with no compromise with his opposition, he starts to look like that. And that is the huge concern. I will have misread him if he proceeds down that path. I thought that he had a little more of a moderate view. There are reasons, as Matt says, that we basically frustrated by the opposition. No one is used to these negotiations where you compromise in Egypt. So this is all new to them. But if he forces this constitution down the throats of the Egyptian people, he starts to look like that kind of a dictator.
But you're now getting people being killed. So you've got a whole new level of concern.
And that's why, Diane, people saying this constitution, this decree is not going to pass because it's now with people's blood. You have 6 people dead, you have 400 wounded. And this is not because of clashes to get rid of old regime. This is after a democratically elected government in office and they acting like this. Now, the army has promised that they're not going to open fire on demonstrators. They allow them to do that. But also being in Tahrir Square is not a strategy. The opposition has to do something. I mean, they can stand there for months, but then what? You cannot demand for the president to step down because he's just been reelected. He didn't have the mandate that he allow him to do what he's doing. He gave himself so much power. But in the end, they have to come to some kind of compromise. Even if he shoved down this constitution down their throat, he's going to leave a divided Egypt in a time of great turmoil. And the U.S. now might even use the leverage of the IMF money that he badly needed to put Egypt back on track to go forward.
But also not just great turmoil, but turmoil that is building up towards a really important deadline. On the 15th of December, this country is supposed to go to a vote to vote on this new constitution. Now, how can that happen? How can that vote, first of all, happen under neutral circumstances where it's a genuinely free vote? How can it happen without violence when you've got violence building up and like sort of boils in several parts of the country? And also, whatever the result, whether it's either voted down or voted up, is it going to be accepted by the whole country? I mean, this is a terrible mess.
I've just had notice here of the death of the receptionist who took the prank call at the hospital that got through to the Duchess. She has committed suicide. No one is giving the reason.
At the hospital in London.
At the hospital in London. Goodness gracious.
Well, I mean, it's appalling. I didn't know. I mean, this is the first I've heard about it. But clearly this person would have been under some pressure from the press, from the palace, maybe from her family.
As to why she allowed the call to go.
But I haven't followed the story that closely, but I can't imagine the pressure being so great.
Wow.
That it would drive someone to do this.
And no one is confirming that the reason was that. Mm-hmm. However, it does seem just appalling. Let's move on to Syria, where there are reports that Bashar al-Assad may resort to using chemical weapons against rebels. What's the evidence?
The intelligence apparatus has confirmed to a number of journalists, and it's been reported that they have indications that he is weaponizing his sarin gas, which is his most lethal of his chemical weapons, putting them into bombs that could be loaded onto aircraft. That's a very worrisome sign if it's true. I don't know that the intelligence is rock solid, but it's certainly enough for the Obama administration to do something which it has not done to date with Syria, which is to draw a clear red line that beyond which America would absolutely become involved. And that is, you know, we've said on this show for many months, Diane, that you know, once the cost of doing nothing began to outweigh the risk of doing something, we would get drawn to this conflict. That tipping point has been passed. You know, NATO is sending missiles to, air defense systems to Turkey for the border there. We are about to recognize the Syrian opposition. Many of our allies in France already have. We are increasingly involved in this conflict because we are seeing it spill over. We're seeing it draw the region in, and we're very worried. We're seeing that Assad is starting to seriously lose power and lose the stalemate. It's no longer a stalemate. He's losing. And we worry very much about what happens the day after he goes. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a power vacuum, and we don't want the wrong people to fill it.
You know, even as we worry about what happens the day after he goes, what about these poor children who are freezing in the streets, who have no electricity, who have no food, who have nowhere to go? The cities are destroyed, Nadia.
Well, the World Food Program, which is a UN organization, has warned yesterday there's 1 million Syrian refugees, mainly men and women and children, are at the mercy of a harsh winter with no access to food or health facilities, etc. And that's the tragedy, the human price, if you want, of this civil war, whatever you wanted to call it. And the Syrian opposition, actually, and many Syrians that I have spoken to in the last week, are livid about the fact that the West and the United States are only going to move if this regime uses chemical weapons. What about the 40,000 dead that's been shot by conventional weapons? That's okay? So we're only going to move because maybe these weapons will fall into the other hand. So it's just, in a way, the dilemma for the West, the hypocrisy that can expose. And also, what do we do when we have a human disaster on our hands and we're not doing much about it?
It's interesting, you know, when you talk to people in the administration, or indeed in London or Berlin, Paris, they're beginning to panic, and for two reasons. One is that as President Assad perceives, or is perceived to be perceiving, that he's losing this war, what's he going to do next? So, après moi le déluge. In other words, I will go down, everyone will go down with me. And that would mean, basically, that's the plausible scenario where he uses chemical weapons. He effectively would become the first president as suicide bomber, not with a vest strapped to him, but using these weapons, which he knows are his doom.
Short break. Right back. Welcome back, Matt Fry. Just before the break, you were talking about what's happening in Syria.
Well, I think, the whole question of biological and chemical weapons is extremely troubling to just about everyone, especially, of course, the people on the ground who might be at the receiving end of this, but also how you deal with this. The point of having a red line, as Washington has announced, is that you hope that a red line would be sufficiently red for people in Syria never to contemplate using this stuff. And the latest satellite imaging and the movements of some of these weapons indicate that this might be different. Now, so you have a red line. What do you do about it? The Israelis and the Americans know it's incredibly difficult to actually take out these chemical biological weapons depots, of which there might be as many as 50, concealing as much as 1,000 tons of this stuff. Because if you use airstrikes, you're going to blow them up and you're going to create precisely what you want to avoid, large toxic clouds moving across the landscape. The other alternative is that you send in special forces and seize it. Well, that's boots on the ground. Obama doesn't want to do that. So it's a really difficult thing to actually deal with in practical military terms.
Just to add to that warning sign, you know, talk about 50 depots. In the last week or so, a rebellion has overrun 6 military installations. Now, we don't know if any of those had these weapons or not, but two of those bases were overrun by al-Qaeda-linked groups that are now fighting on as part of the rebellion. And another thing that has drawn the United States into this was the opposition becoming increasingly radicalized as al-Qaeda in Iraq has flowed into Syria, fighting on the side of the rebellion, fighting very effectively as they have because they've had a lot of experience fighting us. You know, and I'll also say that, you know, when we went into Iraq, we had 140,000 troops. It took months to secure all those weapons depots he had around that country. And in those months, a lot of stuff disappeared and was used against us eventually. Same thing happened in Libya. So my comfort level that no matter what the scenario happens here, that we'll be able to secure 50 weapon sites in a very fluid environment is very low. And I think the Israelis are very concerned about this as well. I think their comfort level is very low because they know that Hezbollah is also operating inside Syria on the side of the Assad regime. Hezbollah is their sworn enemy on their border. And if Hezbollah gets sarin gas, could be very, very worrisome.
In fact, the Pentagon came up with a report last year to say that it needed 75,000 troops on the ground to secure these chemical weapons in Syria. Can you imagine? This is a serious thing, but I think also the message that we keep hearing from the president, from the Secretary of State all the time about this red line and the chemical weapons, a warning to the regime to secure them because they don't want them to fall into, as Jim just said, into the opposition hands or to the jihadist group. I mean, that's the biggest disaster that could have happened.
Is it true that these canisters are now being moved? That's the question.
Well, the intelligence, according to the intelligence, inverted commas, they're saying that they have seen something to indicate that they actually have mixed sarin gas to be used. But we only relying on the intelligence reports. And this is the same intelligence that give us the same information about Iraq.
Not moved out of the bases. They're moved. There's movement within the bases where they're stored and indications that they're being weaponized for possible use. There's no indication yet that they are traveling around or being consolidated for that matter, which might even be a good sign. So we don't know exactly what's happened with these weapons, but everyone, like I said, is very concerned.
The really alarming thing about this is that everyone's just waited too long. The West has waited too long to give the Syrian opposition the kind of recognition which will now come next week in Marrakesh. Hillary Clinton has announced they will recognize the Syrian opposition. Brits have done it already and the French. But this should have come earlier because you want to foster some sort of coherence amongst the opposition because then you have a partner to deal with. Secondly, you notice at a meeting last night, Hillary Clinton talking to the UN special envoy, but also to the Russian foreign minister, Mr. Lavrov. The Russians suddenly realize that their game is up. Assad is finished. And they are scrambling for some exit scenario. And they've realized that having backed him for all these months, years, they don't have anyone, no interlocutors on the opposition side. They're basically out of the game. So they're trying to stitch that up as well. It's a really, really very complicated situation in which everyone is protracted for too long.
How does the fact that Russia is shifting affect Assad's thinking?
Well, here's the most positive scenario, and I think it you know, and something to be watched very closely for. If there's an exile deal where Assad goes to Russia, I mean, it's the only place in the world left probably who would take him. If they can help sort of lead to some sort of soft landing that does not end in retribution massacres, because believe me, all the inner circle from Assad's now looking at their back, looking at their families. Same with his top military people. They want a way out that doesn't mean that their demise. So, you know, that's the best case scenario, is that Russia helps engineer some exile for Assad and some soft landing. You know, short of that, it looks a lot like Libya. This guy's, you know, going to end up strung up someplace, but what we're going to have very little influence over what happens the day after he falls, and that's a very worrisome scenario.
It looks like Libya, sorry, but also in many ways it's worse. I mean, as we've heard so often before, Syria explodes, Libya implodes, right? Then you have a Kurdish situation at the moment. The Kurdish situation, for want of a better word, where you have Kurdish minorities in Turkey, in Iraq, and in Syria, and to some extent in Iran, all yearning for some sort of independence as a result of the moving bits in the puzzle at the moment, is also very explosive, and it gets the Turks even more involved. Mm. I mean, you know, you There has to be some sort of comprehensive settlement, which is unlikely. We talked about Egypt half an hour ago, which is on the brink of civil war. The situation in Syria is full-scale Balkanization, but with chemical, biological weapons and nuclear weapons next door.
A number of you have mentioned Iran. What about this drone that Iran claims to have captured and saying it's a U.S. drone? Nadia.
The Iranians are saying this is part of a psychological warfare between the United States and Iran over the nuclear issue. And therefore, every time they have a drone flying into, the Americans say, international space, the Iranians saying in our space, and we have the right to shoot it down. So far, with this particular drone the Americans saying so far, it's not true. We did not lose any drones.
Could it have been a CIA drone, James?
Yeah, of course. We had a CIA drone, Predator, much more sophisticated drone, you know, taken down or dropped out of the skies over Iran earlier.
And
so
what if that's confirmed?
This latest case has not been confirmed. In fact, the U.S. military is coming out and saying it's not ours. It's a small naval drone. It's in the arsenal of a number of
Persian
Gulf states.
Where else would it have come from?
It could come from Qatar. It could come from any of the Gulf states. Could have come from any of Iran's neighbors who worry about Iran who have this in their arsenal. Well, what I will say, though, is this is not part of a psychological war. We are involved in a shadow war with Iran. We have been over the last couple of years. That involves very sophisticated cyber attacks, involves assassination of Iranian scientists, involves assassination plots from Iran on U.S. soil. This is not assassination of Israeli diplomats overseas. This is not a psychological war. We are involved in a shadow war with Iran, and believe me, it's going to heat up this year because this year is a crucial year. Israel has laid down its own red line. This year, by this summer, they will pass the tipping point where the Israelis think they have to act.
Tell me about the new settlements that Israel is planning now.
Well, settlements have become sort of like Lego blocks on the map in a diplomatic, political, Cold War, sometimes hot war, fought between Israel and the Palestinians. So literally, I think it was the day or 2 days after the Palestinians got their vote at the General Assembly at the United Nations, which, of course, Israel and the U.S. Condemned. The Israelis announced that they would build not 100, not 1,000, but 3,000 new settlements. And crucially, some of the planning would go ahead in an area called E1, which is a neighborhood between Jerusalem and East Jerusalem, which the Palestinians hope will be their future capital, and an existing settlement called Ma'ale Adumim. So basically, if you build those settlements in this area, romantically called E1, it would make the already fairly uncontiguous Palestinian state even less so on the West Bank. So it's, and they're not even, I mean, the bulldozers aren't there. They're not kind of laying the groundwork. They're just sending people with scopes to plan this, you know, this potential building. It's essentially a snub. I mean, they don't actually, it is thought, intend to build there, but they're just sending a signal that this might happen. So this is a political, highly charged game that just adds fuel to the existing fire.
It will kill any real chance of a two-state solution, which I don't really understand how Prime Minister Netanyahu thinks, because ultimately the choices for him is to have one-state solution, which he will never accept, or to have all these Palestinians, 4 million of them, with absolutely no rights, and you will have an apartheid state. And recently, actually, in the last week, they had in the Saban Center, they had this Israel-U.S. dialogue, and they rehabilitated the foreign minister, Lieberman, who basically been seen as an extremist within this Israeli government, and he advocated for the transfer of Palestinians. And he was saying, you don't understand, the problem with the Palestinians is economic. If you make the GDP of Palestinians $10,000, then that's it, we solve it. And actually, it forced Saban himself to come and ask him, then what after? What's next? So the Israelis, I don't know, sometimes they shoot themselves in the foot by declaring this. I don't know if they're going to go ahead and do it, but the peace process effectively is dead. And this administration is not going to spend any political capital on a situation that you see a division within the Palestinians and an extreme right-wing Israeli government. Where we go from there, I don't know.
If you want to consider what a dysfunctional negative spiral this conflict between the Palestinians and Israel is on, consider the fact that what drove Abbas to the UN to go for this sort of meaningless non-member state status was that the settlement activity, and for punishment for that, he gets more settlements. And this sort of negative spiral is what we've seen. I have been to E1, and I can tell you, it's amazing. It's a barren sort of couple of hillsides. Mm. With a lot of infrastructure, very pristine roads, a huge police headquarters complex. It looks like it's been prepared for expansion. And if you do that, it's not only that it makes a future Palestinian state less contiguous. It basically says East Jerusalem could never be the capital of Palestine state because East Jerusalem will be cut off itself from the West Bank. So it makes the Jerusalem issue, which I've always thought was the most difficult and the one that is most implacable here, it takes it off the table in a way that I absolutely agree would kill the two-state solution.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I think, there is a complete lack of leadership from the U.S. on this. I can see why, because, there are not many points to be gained. It's a lousy investment. But without the U.S. taking full leadership responsibility for this, and especially with an election in Israel around the corner in the middle of January, you're just not going to get the kind of solution, the kind of headbanging that you need. And unfortunately, because of events elsewhere in the neighborhood, ultimately, the Israelis will lose out on this one.
Absolutely. And the problem for the U.S. government, U.S. administration, is if you think that you can leave the Middle East as it is and the status quo can prevail, they are wrong, because the situation can always get worse, as the situation in Gaza recently has indicated. All of a sudden, we have almost a full-scale war between Gaza and Israel. And also, to add to James' point, it shows that the moderate who is willing to negotiate with Israel have absolutely nothing, and the extremists who fire these missiles at Israel can actually have a peace deal and be treated as statespeople, and all the foreign ministers of Arab government flooded to Gaza to be seen as supportive of them, and the Egyptian president mediating with Hamas. And Israel actually do negotiate with Hamas, maybe not directly, but they do negotiate with them through other government. And in return, maybe they will lift the blockade or ease the blockade to show that violence maybe some have some fruit.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Ruby. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I wanted to know, since we're arming the rebels even in a roundabout way, and we have intelligence on the ground, and we are the ones that have promoted this action and revolt in Syria, if these chemical weapons are taken by the rebels and somehow get used, are we liable, is any country that's been promoting these rebels, are we liable then for the war crimes that will be committed?
Well, I think, first of all, let's get a couple of things straight. I don't think that we created the situation.
Right.
This situation was created internally by President Assad refusing to bow to a reform agenda, which had been set by the Arab Spring, which was manifested on the streets of Damascus and elsewhere, and which he decided not to deal with. Secondly, whether we are arming the rebels or not, it depends what you're talking about. I mean, it's clearly there are some arms going in from countries like Qatar. It is thought that the Saudis are sending arms in. Those arms might be getting bigger and more effective. I don't really know of any evidence that the United States or Britain has been sending in any weapons. They've been sending in communications equipment, which is incredibly important. So satellite phones, for instance, sent in courtesy of the US or Britain, were able to work for the rebels even after they'd shut down, the government had shut down the internet last week. So these things are vital in a war. You could argue that, a walkie-talkie is as potent as a gun. However, actual weaponry being sent in by the US, I've not seen any evidence of that.
To Indianapolis. Hi, Mohammed. You're on the air.
Thank you so very much. My question is, what can the Western strategy of regime change expect if it continues to back these Arab Spring, so-called Arab Spring, revolts, and we back the leaders into a corner, and they have witnessed the fate of Gaddafi? They witnessed the face of Hussein. They witnessed the face of Osama bin Laden. and many of these people have gas and nuclear weapons. What can we expect if we back them up into a hole and they don't have anywhere to go?
As your listeners often do, it raises a very interesting point and a good point. I think we were right to get on the, you know, once the, and Matt's correct, the Arab Spring was not caused by anything the United States did. This was an internal dynamic of people who have gotten access to technology that lets them see the outside world, and they've had enough of being, you know, subjects of dictators. However, having said that, I thought it was a very poor lesson when Gaddafi was murdered. I thought that it sent a message to the rest of the tyrants in the region that, you know, you either dig your heels in or you'll also end up at the gallows or at the end of an execution's gun. So having said that, I agree. I think Assad, though, many ideas were floated out there that he might have gone into exile early on before he had so much blood in his hands. Now there's very few countries in the world who would accept someone who's killed 40,000 people. Maybe the Russians would be the one.
But someone is asking why the world has not responded with at least a no-fly zone over Syria to prevent the use of chemical weapons.
Well, precisely, I think the movement we have seen now with NATO taking this decision of putting Patriot anti-missile batteries on the border with Turkey, which is around 540 miles, is some see it as a prelude to establish a no-fly zone. It's also linked to what's going to happen in Marrakesh next week, whereby the transitional government is going to be declared. Today, one of the Syrian opposition leaders said that this government is going to be in the liberated areas in northern Syria. So I think this is going to go towards that direction. The West is by any means too late to do anything to save all these people who died there and the people who are dying in the process, but they're doing something now.
Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center. A short break here. Then more of your calls. I look forward to speaking with you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from the Pajamagram Company, offering matching holiday PJs for the entire family at pajamagram.com. From Staples Copy and Print, with print products and services for businesses like brochures and presentations at Staples Stores or staples.com/copy and print. And from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits stay connected to customers using email marketing. Learn more at constantcontact.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember the jazz pianist and composer Dave Brubeck. He died Wednesday at the age of 91. We'll listen back to our 1999 interview with him. Join us.
Welcome back. We'll go right back to the phones to Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning, Willow.
Good morning, Diane. I heard a story on Morning Edition yesterday that really touched my heart. It was about families that have made it out of Syria and that the children are now freezing because there's a severe lack of blankets and supplies. In the particular camp that was featured in the story, there are no international aid agencies. And I have two questions. The first is, why isn't the international community providing adequate support? And secondly, is there something that our family can do to help these children that are dressed in summer clothing and braving 40-degree weather?
You know, it's interesting because most of these refugees are going to Turkey.
Right.
And the wherewithal for Turkey to manage them all is inadequate.
Absolutely. But let me just point out something that I always am surprised by, which is the compassionate feeling of Americans.
Absolutely.
You know, ordinary citizens who are willing to step in and give whatever they can to help people all over the world in conflicts that's nothing sometimes remotely related to their lives. And I really appreciate that. Absolutely. There is international organizations that are working there, but they cannot meet the need. I mean, it is hundreds of refugees are every single day are leaving their homes as fighting intensified in Aleppo and Deir ez-Zor and outside of Damascus and in Daraa. So you see them going to neighboring countries. And Turkey, it said many times that they are unable to deal with these needs. And the same with Jordan, who even have lesser resources to deal with them. And they have these camps in the desert. And the winter is very harsh in northern Syria and in Turkey. So I can only sympathize with these refugees.
Here's an email from Susan in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I've heard that Russia may decide that Turkey is more important to them than Assad's regime in Syria. How likely is that, Matt Pry?
Well, you know, the Russians are forever pragmatic on these matters and have had relatively good relations with the Turks, as far as I recall. But I think for them, especially with Syria, the issue is now, how can they extricate themselves from their commitment to the Assad regime and from what they see rather emotionally as nostalgically as their last outpost in the Middle East? They've got a small naval base in Syria, which I don't think is particularly important strategically for them, but it's got great symbolic importance. They've been supplying the Syrian regime with weapons. They feel completely cut out of the rather chaotic events that are happening at the moment, even though their procrastination on a diplomatic deal helped those events to come about. So in a sense, if you get back to the big Syrian question, how do we get out of this mess? There can be no military solution to this, ultimately. It has to be a political solution. That means the Russians have to come on board. Mr. Assad has to be given some sort of deal, whether we like it or not, to get out, you know, into exile, perhaps in Russia, perhaps elsewhere, with his family, with key cadres of the military establishment, and most importantly, the Alawite minority, which historically had always been overshadowed and dominated by the Sunni majority, which the French colonial rulers put into the army because they were the ones who were kind of ostracized. This we're talking about a century ago or so. They have to be reassured that there is a future for them. Mm-hmm. Because as we see over and over again in the Middle East and as we saw in the Balkans, if you don't reassure powerful minorities that they have a future, there will be a civil war.
You know, Matt says that Russia is ever pragmatic. I that's a description of China to me. Russia to me is always on the wrong side of history, and it will ever be because of lost empire, because of its national character and its own authoritarian regime. It's always going to be siding with the autocrats in these situations. But they are pragmatic enough to know they're on the losing side once again of one of these dynamics. And I do believe that they're looking for, quote unquote, Lavrov's comment, creative solutions at the end. Mm-hmm. Creative solution now is get rid of Assad. And that would be, to me, the best case scenario that's left in Syria.
Here is an email from Oklahoma City. Joseph says, if an international coalition is successful in helping Syrian rebels defeat Assad, should the international community have to focus on the destruction of Syrian stockpiles of chemical weapons as a contingency to the rebuilding efforts, James.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. I mean, that's something that we gladly would fit the bill for. We need to get rid of these weapons. They are an absolute tripwire to any kind of any number of disastrous scenarios in the Middle East. So yes, I think that I also think that, you know, the only leverage we have now is to put money, aid, everything we have in soft power behind the opposition. So the day after Assad leaves, we have some leverage to make sure this does not devolve into an Afghanistan type civil war.
To Houston, Texas, Charles.
Yes, thank you, Diane, and lovely program. Very quickly, the best laid plans that I hear on the show give me great pause. We talk about the opposition as being a unified force, and unfortunately, the largest component of the rebel opposition is both al-Qaeda, Salafist-backed, better funded, better armed, better trained, and I'm trying to figure out a scenario where soft power or diplomacy still doesn't create this extraordinarily horrific civil war. We've already seen the Christians immigrate in mass. We've seen the Armenians. We have the whole history of Lebanon and Syria. But everybody's talking like a unified opposition. That doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, there is a unified political opposition, and this is why the U.S. administration, led by Ambassador Ford, were in Doha hammering these groups to get together and to form what they call now the coalition of Syrian opposition. And this is the one who are going to see probably more recognition by Secretary of State next week in this Friends of Syria meeting in Marrakesh. The ultimate aim is to have some kind of government in exile that will take immediately the day after Assad falls. So this is, seems to be, okay, it's not perfect and it's not where we want it to be, but it seems a step in the right direction, and especially if they go to the so-called liberated areas in northern Syria. But for the military people on the ground, this is the one who's going to call the shot ultimately.
Right.
I don't think the majority of them are Salafists. It's everybody is there. There is a tiny supporters of al-Qaeda, but not everyone.
Let's go to Kansas City. Kansas, Haim, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
First of all, I love your show. I listen to it almost every day. It's a great show. I hope you continue for many, many more years.
Thank you.
I wanted to make two points. I grew up in Israel, and I served in the military there. And it's not Netanyahu who is against the peace process. It's all of the Israelis. They feel betrayed and by the Palestinians, and I don't believe that there'll ever be a peace process, not in the next 4 years, because Netanyahu is going to get reelected. They have elections in Israel in about 50 days, and the polls show him getting reelected. So I don't think there'll ever be peace there. My second comment and my second thing was on the whole war between Gaza and Hamas and Israel. And I feel as I, as a person who has dual citizenship, United American and Israeli, that Hamas is like al-Qaeda, and I don't feel they're treated like al-Qaeda, meaning they have no human respect. They shoot missiles into populated areas, and they're treated like they're the two sides to the story, and both of them are good or both of them are bad. And I don't understand why they're not treated as al-Qaeda, meaning al-Qaeda did 9/11, and they're treated as the bad people. And in Israel, they do it almost every, you know, several months, and they're treated as, you know, a second side.
So. Well, first of all, I don't agree that all Israelis are anti the peace process. I think if you look at all the polls, it shows the Israeli society is divided. It's true that in the recent years, the Israeli society has shifted towards the right, led by this government. But I think, generally speaking, and honestly speaking, I think the majority of Israelis wanted to have a Palestinian state living side by side by the Israelis.
What about equating Hamas with al-Qaeda, Matt Frye?
I think that's wrong. Although there are extremist elements in Hamas, you could call it an extremist organization. It is not a terrorist organization in al-Qaeda sense. Al-Qaeda is relatively faceless. It lives in the shadows. Hamas is running a part of real estate. It's running the Gaza Strip.
Elected.
You might say it's running it very badly, but it is still running it. It can be held accountable through the ballot box, through local council meetings about how it's running everything from the plumbing to its national defense. So it is a completely different entity in that sense. But I think the overall point, and I was based in Israel back in the 1980s when Hamas was first created. I have to say at the time, if I remember correctly, with some help from Israeli intelligence organizations to try and destabilize Fatah. The conclusion I came away with, and nothing much has changed since then, is that sadly speaking, the reality is that both sides, both Israelis and Palestinians, can always be relied upon to bring out the worst in each other. So Hamas rockets fired against southern Israel will create a retaliation from Israel that will drive Hamas further into the extremist camp. The next rocket from the Palestine, from Hamas will increase the power of the Israeli right just before an election, and so it goes.
You know, I take the point. Hamas is, I think it is a terrorist group because it has it kills civilians in large numbers. It did that with suicide bombings during the Second Intifada. However, you know, the story of these kind of struggles is some of these terrorist groups, extremist groups, moderate. The Palestinian Authority, now the moderate in this group, used to be a terrorist organization that downed airliners. Now they're moderates we can deal with. But they have to get into a negotiated process where they take responsibility, and that's not happening.
One story. New details emerged this week about the fire in Bangladesh.
This is a very sad story, Diane. And it repeats again this Western countries, the United States, all of us really wanted to have a cheap garment. We wanted things to be done in factories that pay people $45 a month. In Bangladesh, and is emerging now as the second largest exporter of this garment after China, the world market after China. And the export is almost $19 billion. And they normally recruited very uneducated, poor women from rural area who are desperate to find a job. They go to work in these factories, which I think is about 4,500 factories in Bangladesh now. And there was no inspection. There is no fire hazardous. There is no fire extinguisher. There is no warning for anything. So in this particular factory, there was 112 people died in the most horrific death. There was people trying to bang against iron grids to leave a four-story building. And the blame squarely, it's not just on the Bangladeshi authority, but on the American companies who don't send inspectors to find out the condition of these factories, that the sweatshops that produce all these goods on the cheap.
Perhaps don't want to pay for...
Absolutely. Or they don't want to pay because they wanted these goods to be cheap and manufactured, and there's so much demand worldwide for it.
I think Nadia is absolutely right. And I saw this when I was based in China, that and in Hong Kong, you had this prevalent kind of theme in southern China. There's the desire of the local authorities to set up a factory. There's desire of the factory that is basically had the work outsourced to them to make a profit. So wage levels are low. You spend as little as you can on infrastructure. And then, of course, there's desire of Walmart or Nike or whoever to make a ton of money. Now, there is a solution here, and it's worked in some parts of the world, where you basically put the onus, the responsibility of safety onto the company that makes money out of this. And, you know, you can hold Walmart's feet to the fire on this one. In America, or you could hold in any company operating in a Western consumer environment where there is this consciousness.
Happened?
It hasn't happened sufficiently.
Yeah.
It clearly didn't happen in this case.
Right. Yeah, and you need public awareness of why do we want to buy this cheap clothes and to see the conditions of these poor women who die as a result of it.
And if we're forced to pay because of that more for these products, maybe it'll be actually create some space for American workers to make them.
James Kitfield, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hi, Daphne.
Hi, I was also moved by yesterday's reports on the refugees, of the Syrian refugees. And I called a priest that I know is from the Antiochian Archdiocese of the Orthodox Christian Church, which is, its base is in Damascus, Syria. So they collected money a month ago already. But I'm sending a check today, but if you want an address, I'd be happy to give it to you.
Why don't you give it to our phone answer, Natalie, and we'll be happy to put some sources up on the web. Go ahead, Matt.
There's another point I think we should mention, which is that a very large number of people are not refugees because they haven't gone into Turkey yet. They are internally displaced within Syria. And if you're internally displaced in a country that's in the middle of a raging civil war, there is really very little that the UNHCR that deals with refugees can do. In fact, it can do nothing. So the UNHCR is beefing up its operations, as far as I understand, on the Turkish border, waiting for people to come across. They can do more there, and I think they're in the process of trying to do that. But when it comes to those tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people internally displaced within Syria who are desperate enough to leave their homes but not yet desperate enough to leave the country, or they simply can't leave, those are the really tough people to get hold of, because you're actually having to provide aid in the middle of a civil war.
So I want to go back, Matt, to your point about holding American companies accountable. Apparently, the Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that Walmart had contracted with an approved supplier, Simco, to manufacture 300,000 girls' shorts. Simco was over capacity, so they subcontracted the order to Tuba Group without Walmart's knowledge, who then subcontracted the order to Tazreen Fashions.
Exactly.
Neither of these subcontractors was authorized by Walmart to do business with it. Who do you hold accountable?
Still Walmart, I think. At the end of the day, if it's sold on... I mean, look, I don't know what the legal basis for this, but I'm just talking as a citizen.
Right.
So I think, you know, if it's sold by Walmart, if they make, you know, the biggest profit out of it, if it's their margin, then they have to set in place a system of oversight and accountability that goes all the way to the final outsourcer. It doesn't matter whether it's outsourced once or twice or three times. They need to be aware of that process. And that's not too much to ask for. I mean, there's a couple of phone calls and emails to be sent to establish where the stuff is being made. And then they have to send their own people over to Bangladesh or China or Vietnam and make sure that together with the local authorities, they are, you know, they check that the fire escape is working and all the apparatus is in place. That surely must be possible, and everyone has to gain from it.
Tuba Group owns the Tazreen, and the manager of Tazreen was saying basically, we don't know who is selling our garment to. We have a middleman. We are a small factory here. We sell it to the middleman sell it. But Walmart and Sears and others, even Marine Corps were buying from them. Basically, they have the full responsibility to know who they're buying from. It doesn't matter who they're selling to, but they're the one who's buying things, and they know that it's done in Bangladesh. And to be honest with you, anybody doesn't know that it's going to be a cheap labor market under very bad conditions that are going to produce these things. We all know that. You don't need to, you know, so much information. So I think ultimately they're the one who's responsible for
Not
it.
Not yet, Bill. They see it. Middle East Broadcast Center, Matt Fry. He's Washington correspondent for the UK's Channel 4 News. James Kitfield, senior correspondent for National Journal. Have a great weekend, everybody.
You too.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.